So hey friends, tonight is week two in the series that we've been walking through starting last week called Soma. And if you remember, Soma is the word that's used in the New Testament that refers to our bodies, but it also refers to the body of Christ, meaning the church. So if you want to, we've been recording these messages, so you can go onto our webpage, the high school page of our website, and you can find the audio from these messages if you'd like to go back and listen or if you miss a week. But just to recap, if you weren't here, if you need a refresher, last week we started off this series talking about the story of the body, how the body is an integral part of the story of the scriptures and the story of the gospel, that our bodies are good, broken, but will be redeemed. And so we come into life with a certain kind of paradigm, a certain story that we're living into. And Jesus is calling us to live into his story, to live into his paradigm, a way of viewing, thinking about, and using our bodies that is a part of the story he's writing into the world. So tonight, we're going to talk about sexual integrity and what this means and why we ought to be stewards of our bodies towards the good gifts that God has intended our bodies to be used, either the covenant of marriage or celibacy. And if you don't know what celibacy means, that's a way of saying being single. Neither of those words are probably great. They have some baggage and some connotations, but for lack of a better word, celibacy or singleness, right? These are ways other than marriage that we can embody God's vision for our bodies and for our sexuality. So to give you a look ahead to in the future, next week when Chuck's here, he's going to be talking about desire and pornography and screens and habits and all the ways that this stuff can captivate us. And then in coming weeks after that, we'll talk about same-sex relationships, and we'll talk about gender identity and expression and role and those kinds of things. And then we'll conclude the series talking about dating and relationships. So some significant and important stuff to come in the next few weeks. But these first 2 weeks, we're laying a foundation. This is important, right? You got to get it. We're laying a foundation. We're developing a framework and a base from which we step into some of the more difficult, confusing, and even practical things regarding sexuality and our bodies. So the theology and dealing with desire comes before the do's and the don'ts and the rules and all that stuff, right? So that's what we're going to do today, is look again at what we do with desire, what we do with our sexuality, especially in light of the culture that we're in and the temptations and the inclinations that our culture is filled with and that saturates our world as a sexualized culture. So I want us to look at this, though, from the perspective of beauty. Because there's a way of approaching this conversation, right? And this, we talked a little bit about this last week. There's a way of approaching this conversation that is, where it's my role to scare you out of having sex, right? And it's I become the sex ed teacher who tells you all about STDs and pregnancy and the unforeseen and sometimes unwelcome things that can happen when you have sex. And I want you to know that's not my job. Thank God. That is not what I'm here to do. And I also don't think it's the best approach, the best way to enter into this conversation. If the church could scare teenagers out of having sex, that probably would have already worked. So my guess is that we need a better story. We need an alternative imagination for a better way of life, a way that can bring flourishing and fullness in the midst of the desires and the sexuality that we carry within us, and fear doesn't grip us in the way that beauty does. Aesthetics, beauty does something to our desire that fear or shame or any other motivating factor can never accomplish, can never do. And that's why fear and shame are not a part of the motivational toolkit of Jesus, but beauty and goodness are. So I want us to see, why is this desirable? Why does this have power? There's a philosopher named Peter Kreeft who says this. He says, there is no argument against beauty. Truth, goodness, and beauty are the three things we all need and need absolutely, and know that we need and need absolutely. There's another theologian, his name is Carl Truman. He puts it this way, that arguments can be true or false, good or bad, but today, who cares? We live in an age where the primary moral binary is between the tasteful and the distasteful. Control of aesthetics is where the real power to change people lies. So this is why we start this conversation with story, because we are formed and shaped by the stories in which we inhabit. And the only way to truly transform our desires and to live into a different kind of story is to encounter something that to us has ultimate beauty, ultimate desirability that we can look at and not just say, oh, that's true, but say, oh, that's good. I want that. So my role here, right, not the sex ed teacher, I would like to imagine a little bit of the way that we're entering into this conversation like this. So my role is to be kind of like a art gallery curator. And I'm trying to put a theology of sex and the body on display in the best possible light for you so that you can enter into this space and be drawn to the goodness and the beauty of the art and the design that God has created for our bodies and for sexuality. So we're going to put this in the best possible light so that we see the beauty that God has for us and his design for sexuality. That's what we're trying to do. That's what we're trying to get into. So in order to do that, you got a copy of the scriptures with you. I hope you do. If you don't, there's some in the back there. But we're going to be in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. So I need you to go ahead and find that in your Bible. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. That's where we'll be spending our time tonight. And just to give you a little bit of background, 1 Corinthians is a letter that the apostle Paul wrote to the church in Corinth. And Corinth was a prominent city in the ancient world and in the first century. It was originally a city-state that was a part of ancient Greece. And then in 146 BC, Rome came and they wiped Corinth off the map, burned it to the ground, killed most of its people, and it laid kind of dormant for a while. And then in 44 BC, so you know the story of the assassination of Julius Caesar, right? This famous thing, Shakespeare's got a whole play. Right, so in 44 BC, Julius, right before he's assassinated, he goes and he founds Corinth as a Roman colony and reinstates this thing as a colony, as a part of the Roman Empire in this day. And because of its ideal location, it's right between two seas, it becomes this very profitable, like, Mecca, this urban center that's got all kinds of influence and power and luxury and wealth. It's ornamental. It's filled with all kinds of abundance. And not only that, but because of all the wealth and the luxury that was a part of this city, the life of the city and the people, the culture there, was filled with a celebration of sexuality that was in some ways common and in some ways unparalleled in the ancient world. They worshipped the goddess Venus there, as well as Poseidon and some others. And it was common in that day to have sexual practice as a part of your religious rites and your religious practices at the temples. So you would have temple prostitutes and all these kinds of things. Paul spends more time in the letter to the Corinthians talking about sexuality in the body than any other time, any other letter, any other book of the New Testament. Because this community and this culture was saturated by sexuality in the world in which they live. And although there's like a million and one differences between ancient Corinth in the first century and our world, our culture today, there are some fascinating parallels. When I think about a progressive, secular, urban center that's diverse and that celebrates sexuality, it's not hard for me to draw a parallel from ancient Corinth to the world in which we live today as American citizens. So I want us to see, in the passage that we're going to look at, that although there are some obviously different things, some different language, some different contexts, there's something super relevant to what Paul has to say to the church in Corinth that speaks to us still today in the modern context in which we find ourselves. So, I'm going to be reading out of the ESV translation, by the way. I know some of those Bibles back there are NIV, but I like the way that this kind of frames it and uses the language in this passage. So, 1 Corinthians 6, I'm going to start in verse 12 and read to the end of the chapter. This is what Paul writes. And he's quoting here, by the way. He's quoting the Corinthians in these first couple of verses. So, quote, "All things are lawful for me." That's what the Corinthians are saying. But Paul says, not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be dominated by anything. Again, the Corinthians say, food is meant for the stomach and the stomach for food. And God will destroy both one and the other. The body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. And God raised the Lord and will also raise us up by his power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For as it is written, quotes Genesis here, the two will become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord becomes one spirit with him. Flee from sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body, but the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. Again, or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God? You are not your own, for you were bought with a price. So glorify God in your body. Now I want us to look at two arguments that Paul essentially cites the Corinthians as making. Two dominant points that the Corinthian culture is trying to get across. Two things they're trying to convey that Paul and the way of Jesus wants to push back against here, right? So the first one is this, and he quotes the Corinthians as saying it, right? The Corinthian way here. All things are permissible for me. This is what the Corinthians want to say. I can do whatever I want. And legally speaking, they were right. They lived in a culture where they had so much control over their bodies. Now, huge caveat to this, picture in parentheses here. If you were a Roman man, okay? If you were a woman or if you were a slave, this did not apply to you, right? But for people who were the patriarchs in their culture, you had all the law on your side. You could do whatever you wanted. Men in Corinth and in the Roman Empire in this time, they had the rights to the bodies of their wives, their mistresses, and their slaves, male or female. It didn't matter. There was no legal repercussions to taking ownership and objectifying and exploiting the body of another person if you were a man in this culture, if you were the patriarch in your home, in your family. So, in a very literal sense, for people who that applied to, it did, right? They had all this stuff that was permissible to them. But in a broader sense, for the culture as a whole, right, the dominant mentality is that we can do whatever we want. Our bodies, right, they belong to us to do with as we please. I am in control of my own body. And there's an aesthetic to this, right? There's a beauty. The thing that we long for, the thing that sounds good and desirable about this is control. We long to have control over our own bodies. I would say one of the things that is so valued so highly in our culture is autonomy. Right? We want to be the masters of our own fate, the captains of our own soul. We want to be the people in charge of us. We want to say, along with Corinth, it's my body, I can do what I want with it. If you don't hear that in our culture, you might need to listen in closely, because that's not a new thing. That's an echo of something thousands of years old. And I see that parallel between the world of Corinth and our world today, that we want to be autonomous. We want to have control over our own bodies to say it's mine and I can do with it what I want. I don't know if it's the greatest value, but it's probably up there. And especially when it comes to sexuality, we want to think that we're the arbiters over what is good. We get to define the way that we use our bodies for our own ends. And there is no higher authority. There is no one above us who gets to say how to think about and how to use our bodies. We want to be the authority figures when it comes to our own bodies and our own sexuality, right? And in all of these things that we're going to talk about tonight, I hope you hear that there is a hint and a sliver of truth in this, right? Because as stewards, we are called to a certain kind of ownership and accountability and responsibility for our bodies. Nobody else is in charge of our bodies but us, right? So there is a sort of truth to this. But when we chase after this as the highest good, when autonomy and control over our own bodies and what we do with them becomes the thing that we seek out most, when it becomes ultimate to us, then we're asking that beauty to do more than it really can to produce flourishing in our lives. The beauty of control, we might be asking more of it than it can actually produce for us. That's what happens when we want to be in control. So I recently read this article from a woman. She was writing for the Washington Post. And I've read multiple articles like this in the past few weeks. And the article that she's writing, she was reflecting on an experience where she had, where she went back to her college alma mater, and she went and sat in as a columnist for the Post, kind of a guest sat in auditing this freshman orientation. And at this freshman orientation, the older students and the faculty kind of collaborated to put on this skit that portrays the importance of consent and sexual boundaries for the freshmen. And she actually went to this skit back when she was a freshman years and years prior. Before she took this job as a columnist at the Washington Post, she sat in and she saw a version of this same kind of skit. And the skit features these students who they go to this party, right? Classic college party situation, and there's drinking and whatnot. And it gets into kind of this gray area of, where there's this hookup moment, right, between a guy and a girl, and there's drinking involved, and so there's confusion over consent. And then they walk back through the rest of the skit once it finishes. And they kind of say, hey, okay, this is what should have happened here. This should have been said here. We should have not crossed this line. We should have set up this boundary. We should have communicated this way. And they talked about the importance and necessity of consent. And I seriously hope you hear this, right? Consent is 100% essential and good, right? But she walked away feeling something different than she felt the first time she'd seen this. Because when she was a freshman, she was like, yeah, all right, great. But she walked away a little bit older now, having had a little bit more life experience. And she felt bothered that the only thing we could seem to muster, the only thing that we could seem to call out as a value and as significant in a sexual encounter was consent. And she started to wonder if maybe there was something a little more that was being left out. So I was fascinated by this. This is a quote from her article as a takeaway that she had as she left the training. She says, as a culture, while we're much better at calling out bad behavior, we haven't come to an agreement on what's good. Consent is the line we use to separate the acceptable from the unacceptable, but it's thin and often detached from a real understanding of the human person. While consent is a helpful legal framework for risk avoidance, it too often allows us to bypass questions of respect, relationship, and care. Is the worst thing about taking advantage of a drunken classmate really the fact that you didn't get her mouth to yes first? She asks this rhetorical question, right? Not that consent is a bad standard in and of itself. We don't need less than consent, but maybe we need something more than consent. And she's not the first person in our culture to start wondering this. I have no idea if she's a Christian. She's not approaching this from the lens of she read Corinthians. She's approaching this from the lens of someone who's had some life experience and knows what it means to live in a sexual culture and experience sexual encounters and navigate the messy real world stuff of relationships and consent and all these boundaries that we try to create in our culture where control, your own control of your body and respecting someone else's control over their body, is the only value we have left. That's the only sin in our culture, is to violate someone else's control over their own body. And she's starting to wonder, this is what I want us to consider too, maybe is there something even more? What if it's not just about us? What if it's actually about the other person when we come and start talking about sex? What if sex is not a way to assert our own personhood and control over our bodies as some kind of empowered thing? But what if sexuality is actually best when it's just an act of surrender? It's an act of vulnerability. And it's not about self-assertion and control. It's about self-giving and love. What if that's the best and most healthy and flourishing way to view our sexuality? And what if we could even go this far? More than consent, we need covenant. What if there's a risk inherent in sexuality, but that for our good and for our flourishing, God has provided a means through which we can experience the fullness of our sexuality within the confines and the safety and the limits of a covenant. And this is exactly what Paul is trying to get the people to understand. So he casts this vision for them in verse 18. He says, flee from sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits, it's outside the body, but the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. In other words, right? Like, while the conversation around how to avoid harming others is important, we probably also need to pay attention to what are we doing to ourselves when we engage in sexual encounters and when we consider the sexuality of our bodies and desires that we carry. He goes on, right? Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God? You are not your own, for you were bought with a price. So I want to say that contrary to the way of Corinth, there is a way of Jesus. And this may not sound like good news to us at first, but it is. And the way of Jesus is this, that you are not your own. Your body does not exclusively and authoritatively belong to you, but in fact, You have been made a steward of your body to glorify God through the way that you use your body and steward your sexuality. And this is a desire not so much for control, but for covenant. To long for the goodness and the desirability of a relationship. And covenant here, right? Yes, refers to marriage, but it actually pictures and moves us past marriage into the covenant that we have with God himself. And this is what marriage does so beautifully, right? Marriage, the relationship, the covenant between husband and wife is intended for us to picture and to symbolize the relationship and the covenant that exists between humanity and God. And so marriage, the covenant that exists within that, portrays for us the beauty of a safe and limited expression of our sexuality. So rather than running after control and autonomy, what if we need to start running after self-giving and self-offering and surrender as we enter in and get older and start to experience the temptation and the draw towards sexuality? How can we view that through the lens of covenant rather than control? Because this is what Jesus does for us. So Paul, later in 1 Corinthians, in 1 Corinthians 11, he's recounting the scene, the Last Supper. And as he's talking about this, he quotes from Jesus, right? And he talks about the scene there. And he says that Jesus, on the night that he was betrayed, he was with his disciples and he took bread. And after giving thanks for it, he blessed it and he broke it. And what's he say to his friends? He says, "This is my body, which is for you. This is my body, which is for you." It's a completely different paradigm and a completely different posture for the way that we think about our bodies. And Jesus sets the pattern. Jesus sets the tone. Our bodies are not for ourselves, owned by ourselves. We are stewards of our bodies for the good and for the gift and the offering towards others. This is what our bodies are made for. So, I wonder if we could say along with Jesus, right? This is my body, which is for you. It's for others, not just for ourselves, to gratify the desires of the flesh. Now, there's a second argument that the Corinthians make. A second thing that they want to say that Paul wants to push back against and offer a different paradigm. So here's the second thing, the Corinthian way. They say the stomach was made for food and food for the body. In Greek here, there's no verbs or anything. The sentence is literally, it's kind of this axiom. Stomach for food for body. Or food for stomach, right? They just say it's kind of this way that you can easily kind of, it's like an incantation, just get it in your brain, right? Stomach for food for stomach. But Paul wants to push back against this idea, right? Because here's what they're saying. They're saying that sexuality is like an appetite, same as any other appetite. So, right, if the stomach was made for food, then your sexuality was made for having sex. So if you're hungry, eat, and if you're aroused, then have sex. This is the thought process that the Corinthians are espousing, right, where they just long for the release of pleasure. And then when we engage in and experience the pleasure that comes from exploring and expressing their sexuality. So Paul wants to push back against this idea, the simplistic and reductionistic understanding of what sex is for, that it's not the same as any other appetite of the body. It's not intended to be satisfied in the same way or to the same extent as every other appetite of the body. There's something significant beyond pleasure to the meaning of sex. And this is what the culture then, this is what our culture now doesn't seem to often understand. Sometimes, right, especially like before I was married, right, it's easy to imagine that sex is the pinnacle and the peak of human happiness because it's the moment. You can't have any more pleasure than that, and it must be this incredible thing, right? And so it's always worth chasing every chance you get, every encounter you can have, you probably should have. And there's an endless curiosity and a hunger and an appetite and energy and a drive for sexuality. And we don't want to, we don't know how to pump the brakes on that if we reduce it to something as merely an appetite of the body. Paul wants us to see that there is a significance and a power to sex and what it can do in us, to us, through us, to others, that is more than just gratifying pleasure, right? So maybe we don't say something like the stomach was for food and food for the stomach. We probably don't use that kind of language. But we think things, we say things like, it's just sex, what's the big deal? It's just skin, it's just body parts, why does this matter, right? I mean, this is the mentality where we reduce sexuality and it's just the physical act. And what could possibly be the significance and the meaning beyond the physical union? Could there be possibly any spiritual significance, any emotional and relational significance to what's happening in sex? Paul wants to say profoundly, absolutely, yes, there is. In fact, the most important thing about sex is not the physical union for Paul. For Paul, it's the spiritual union that sexuality enters us into and pictures for us. But oftentimes, we go the reductionist route, right? So there's a, some of y'all may have seen the show Friday Night Lights, okay? In this show, Friday Night Lights, there is there's a character named Julie, and she's in the first, I think she's 15 or so in the first season. And she has a boyfriend who is the quarterback of the Dillon Panthers, okay? They live in small town Texas where football is life. And so her dad is the coach of the football team, and everywhere, that's the only thing anybody really cares about. And she's been dating this guy who's the quarterback, and he seems nice, and they like each other. And at one point, after they're hanging out, she says to him, hey, I think we should have sex. And he's like, okay, yeah, that sounds good. Right? Like, no thought process at all. Reflex for him. And so they say goodnight, and she's like, all right, well, yeah, let's start making that happen. And so he goes to the store the next day, and Julie's mom is there. And Matt, the quarterback, doesn't know it, but her mom sees him buying condoms at the store. And so she doesn't say anything. She doesn't confront him, right? But her mom goes home and has one of those, I don't know, I'm not a daughter, so maybe you can imagine this, right? But she has one of these, like, mom-to-daughter conversations that's just here, right? And so she, you know, they kind of go into the living room and they don't even sit down. They just kind of jump right in. And she's like, hey, Julie, anything that you want to talk about? No, Mom, I don't think so. And she's like, are you sure? Is there anything that maybe you need to tell me? No, I really don't think so, Mom. I'm good. She's like, I saw Matt Saracen buying condoms at the store today. She's like, oh, that, yeah, oh, I was just about to talk about that. And so she reluctantly enters into this conversation, and you can kind of imagine the scene, right, how this goes, where Mom tells Julie, hey, this is a big deal. Have you thought about this? And she says this. She says that, you know, sex is for people who are in love, and she uses the phrase making love. And Julie gets this, like, smirk on her face, and she kind of giggles and looks away shyly, awkwardly, like, I can't believe my mom just said that. People don't talk about sex like it's making love. That's so funny, so embarrassing. What an old person thing to say. And her mom, like, freaks out and starts crying. It's like, you can't believe that you don't see what this is, and you don't see how it's more significant than just bodies. And this is what Julie says. She goes, Mom, what is the big deal? It's a body part and a body part touching, like, I don't understand the significance here. And she can't seem to get her daughter to understand that maybe there's something in your imagination, right? Something in your perception of what sex is that is lacking. And what if it is more than just physical union? What if there is something of far greater and far deeper power and significance in the act of sex beyond just the physical union? And when you're young, right, this is so hard for us to see and to imagine. I get it. It really is. Because on paper, this is scientific and technical, and it's got nothing to do with anything except a way to be close to somebody that you like and experience some pleasure, and it's some harmless fun. But Paul wants us to see that there's actually something of so much deeper significance and power to sex. And the contrast of this episode is pretty stark to me. Because as Julie and her mom are having this conversation, there's another plot development. There's another story arc in the episode where a guy who owns a business, who's a big part of the town, a big part of the football program, it becomes public knowledge that he's had an affair. And his marriage and his career and his reputation are trashed. And everything just gets, like, blown apart in a single moment when this becomes public knowledge. And there's just destruction left and right with his family and his wife, his kids. And it's an interesting parallel. That one person, and Julie ends up, by the way, deciding not to have sex, right? So, win for moms. And she comes to this realization, right, that maybe there was something more significant than she understood about this in the first place. Maybe there's something a little more important, a little more meaningful to what sex is all about than just bodies touching and the pursuit of pleasure. And she learns through wisdom, right? But the guy who owns the car dealership, who's in the football program, buddy, right, who has this affair, he learns the hard way. And he's much older, but he still hasn't learned the lesson that sex is about something so much more powerful than just pleasure. And here's the thing, right? Sex has the power to bind and to unite, or to tear down and to destroy. Sex has the power to bring life or to bring destruction. And wisdom will allow us to discern that there is something of far greater significance to sex than just pleasure. So, the way of Jesus, again, pushing back against this story, this picture of pleasure as the greatest and ultimate end. The way of Jesus goes like this. The body is meant for the Lord, and the Lord is meant for the body. So I use the language here of telos. This is the beauty of telos. And telos is a word that means the designed end or goal of something, the object or aim for which a thing was created, its destiny and its ultimate purpose, right? So the telos of a key is a lock. The telos of a sailing ship is the sea. The telos of a satellite is orbit, right? The telos is the thing for which a purpose is destined, right? The thing for which sexuality is intended to ultimately be used for. And what Paul wants us to see is that sex has a telos beyond pleasure. It includes pleasure, right? Pleasure's not a bad thing, just like control is not an inherently bad thing, but when these good things become ultimate things, we distort the telos, the purpose, the end of sex. There is something beyond this that we deeply need to understand about sex. We will not get flourishing, we will not get happiness, we will not get contentment by continually chasing after pleasure. So I saw this interview with a guy. He's a doctor in California. He's an endocrinologist, and he teaches at a University of California out there. And he was doing this interview about a new book that he wrote called The Hacking of the American Mind. And it sounds like kind of weird and scary and dark, but it's just about the way that our culture and our industry and our economic system, all this stuff influences us and tries to sell us pleasure. And so he talks about the way in which we have, as a culture, confused and conflated pleasure with happiness, meaning we think that they're the same thing, and they're not. Pleasure and happiness are not the same thing. And again, he's not approaching this conversation saying that because he's read Paul necessarily. He's saying this as a scientist and as a doctor who understands some things about brain chemistry. So he goes on and he talks about it this way. He says that pleasure is associated with the chemical dopamine, and happiness is associated with the chemical serotonin. Dopamine excites the neurons in your brain, producing the feeling that we call pleasure. But serotonin inhibits the neurons in your brain, which produces the feeling we call happiness, which leads to the process of contentment. And in our brains, we downregulate dopamine, which means that we can build up a tolerance to dopamine, right? And eventually, we can become addicted. We have less receptors in our brain that are responding to this, so we need more and more and more of something to feel that same level, right? That same rush, that same sense of pleasure. We need more in something because we're building up a tolerance to it. That's what happens with dopamine. And eventually, that happens long enough, to far enough extent, you can become addicted to something. But our brains don't downregulate serotonin. Meaning you cannot be addicted to too much happiness. He says, though, there is one exception. There is one thing that downregulates serotonin, and it's dopamine. So literally, right, dopamine can increase your body's resistance to serotonin. Here's what's happening on the non-brain chemistry level, right? When you seek out pleasure and you confuse it and you replace it with happiness and with contentment, you're actually limiting your ability to experience true contentment and happiness. In other words, you will never experience happiness by pursuing pleasure. This is stuff that exists. I mean, I'm telling you, right? Like, we've known this from a spiritual standpoint for thousands of years, but like literally in our brains, we're starting to process and see this. You cannot get happiness. You cannot get fullness and flourishing and contentment and the endless pursuit of pleasure. It does not work that way. Your brain, your body is not meant to run on pleasure. So if we want something more out of sex, we've got to look past pleasure. We've got to look to something more meaningful that can produce lasting fullness, a lasting flourishing in our lives. So just to summarize for you, right? Control and pleasure, good things, not ultimate things. And there is a better way, a more beautiful story that I hope we can be drawn to and see the power of and the desirability and the goodness of. The way of Jesus is going to push us into some healthy kind of limits. It's going to push us past our reflex impulse for pleasure. And it's going to drive us, though, into something deeper and long that we long for that's more beautiful to us. It's going to drive us into covenant. And it's going to drive us ultimately into the arms of Jesus, who wants to receive us, welcome us, love us, and help use our bodies for his glory and for his kingdom. So I would just ask, as we send you guys out into groups here in a moment, can you look through and see where am I drawn to pleasure? Where do I tend to assert ownership of my body that's not rightfully mine? Where do I tend to use my body or use other people's bodies in ways that are not aligned with the way of Jesus? What tends to be a draw and a temptation for me? If you can name reality, it's the first step towards a transformation in forming our sexual ethic in the way of Jesus. Let me pray for you. Father God, I thank you that you love us. You love us more deeply than we know. Your grace fills every scar, every wound, every hole, and every broken road will be made straight. So Lord, I thank you that your kingdom is coming into the world, that we get to be a part of it. I pray that you would show these students an inside look at their own hearts, at their own desires, that we would deal first with our error in worship before we start looking for the right rules to follow. And that we would be surrendered to you and to your way above all things. In your name, amen. Y'all are dismissed to your groups.